Hi there, I'm Jason McMullen.
And I'm Kate Ariano. Welcome to Words Aloud.
We love books. We love stories, poems, memoirs, narratives, and any kind of written or spoken word that moves us.
That's why we created Words Aloud, a space for us to invite writers of all kinds to share their pieces that we like.
Come get lost in words. You're with friends here.
Today on Words Aloud, we'll speak with
Allison Detterman, a student and author at the University of Connecticut. Allison is here today to share a piece of fiction. I'll get out of the way now. Here's Allison Detterman.
Grandpa always says that the bog doesn't talk, but it speaks. On nights when the wind ran through the trees like a mother brushes hair out of her child's face, Grandpa would wake me and take me to the window. Even as far back as I can remember, even when I could hardly trust my own steps, he would take my hand and guide me out onto the roof, metal sheets warm beneath my sleep-soft feet. If you go out onto the roof at sunset, the breeze off the bog is already impossibly cold. I used to think that the wind brought air from places where the sun had already set. I used to picture the wind carrying with it the breath of the people who lived beyond. It doesn't, of course. The bog's breath is the bog's breath alone. Grandpa speaks the language of the bog like nobody I've ever met, and I think those nights were him trying to teach it to me. I never knew how long we stayed out on the roof, but most nights the sun would rise and we'd still be standing there, one of us hearing the bog speak. Even on the nights he didn't take me with him onto the roof, he was always there. Most mornings I would wake to see him outside my window, still standing but with his eyes closed, like he had fallen asleep in the middle of a conversation. I grew up on the bog, but the bog doesn't speak to me. I am on the roof now, watching the dark, still water of the early morning. It's late enough in the season that the bog is thawing, the swishing and clacking of cranberry buds becoming louder each day. Over their noise, I can just barely hear the two men knocking at our front door. I think it's the first time in my life that I've heard that sound. I've never seen policemen before, but the boys have described them to me often enough that I'm pretty sure that's what I'm looking at. They came in a car with blue lights on top, and they both have guns. I watch them knock for a little while. Nobody is going to let them in. Grandpa is not on the roof tonight. He was dying for three harvests, and last year his eyes were so clouded over that he couldn't see the berries, even when the mid-March buds flared red under the July sun. Of course, he didn't need to see to know that the berries were ready to harvest. Grandpa spoke the language of the bog like nobody I've ever met, like it was his to understand. The policemen are still knocking at the door, louder now. If they looked up, they would see my jagged silhouette cut into the March constellations, the same March constellations that light the sky every spring. But they don't look up. I wonder if they'll leave when nobody answers, or if they'll just walk right in. They could, of course. The door isn't locked. There's no reason I would have locked the door, because normally there wouldn't be another person here for a couple months at least. The boys, whose bare backs glisten golden in the sunlight, will come in the fall to load the cranberry crates into their trucks and drive them to market. But in the spring, it's just me and Grandpa. And after yesterday, I guess it's just me. Jesus, do you think we've got to go in there? One of the men stomps his feet and huffs. I can see the white cloud of his breath even from up on the roof. It's an early spring, but nights still have the sharp, wet kind of cold that only blows off half icy bogs. Give it a minute. Didn't there used to be a girl around here, too? I suppose I could go down and let them in. It's bitter cold, and neither one of them has a coat. The boys used to tell stories of policemen taking them to a concrete jail for doing something as simple as drinking and needing to call their parents to pick them up. Now Grandpa is dead. There's nobody left for me to call. I wonder if I would have to stay in the concrete jail forever, or at least until I starve to death. I stay on the roof. Nah, that was a long time ago, the other policeman says. His daughter died years ago. There's nobody else in the house. His daughter didn't have kids? I don't think she'd have known how if she wanted to. Poor thing. My mother was simple, but I don't see why they think my mother wouldn't have been able to have sex. One of the boys had sex with me once. All you really have to do is lie there and try not to scream. It would have been worth it if he was telling the truth about marrying me afterwards and taking me to his house beyond the bog. But he was lying. You think he's dead? One of the police officers asks. He was what? 80? The other one sighs, thin white cloud. We probably have to go in and check it out. I think about Grandpa. I don't know how I should picture him, if his eyes are open or closed. I want to imagine them closed, but I can only picture them open. For 2 weeks before he died, his eyes were the glassy eyes that belong to the dead or dying, a shining film over them so thick it looked as though they had just bobbed to the surface among the cranberries. They looked like my eyes, the night I was baptized in the bog. The only reason I know what my eyes looked like is that my mother took a photo. The first winter I was alive, I fell to the grips of an unknown fever. My mother was distraught at the idea I wouldn't survive, so she begged my grandfather to baptize me. As he did, she took a photo to remember me by, the only photo of me that exists. I wouldn't even recognize myself in it if it weren't for Grandpa's unmistakable hands holding me up. I got better the next day and never had problems with sickliness again. My mother praised the Lord every night for my survival, and Grandpa let her. But he knew the truth. It wasn't the Lord who had saved me. It was the bog. And the bog was not as benevolent a master as Jesus. The cops have now figured out that the door is unlocked. I hear their footsteps and muffled voices in the kitchen. They're the first people in the kitchen besides me and Grandpa since my mother. I don't like that they're in our house. They weren't even invited in. I wonder what they're doing. I figure they might be looking for his body, even though it's none of their business. They're not going to find it. I let Grandpa's body float away into the bog already, like he asked me to. When they realize the house is empty, I wonder if they'll get the idea to check the water. It would be stupid of them, but they might do it anyways. They might not know how vengeful the bog can be towards people who don't know how to respect it. You have to know your feet, have to know your vines, or you can get snagged beneath the water and thrash yourself to death trying to get back up. My mother was simple and could hardly corral the berries without getting tangled in the vines that swayed underfoot. 3 weeks after the bog saved my life, my mother drowned in the middle of the night. My grandfather found her in the morning, with less than 6 inches of water above her head. Grandpa always used to say that it was the bog's way of protecting itself. The only people who ever got snagged were the ones who were tearing up roots. Accidents don't matter to the bog. I wouldn't know what the bog was thinking. It doesn't speak to me. There is nobody left to speak to me. I didn't have any photos of Grandpa, so I took one of him yesterday as he was floating away. If I squinted, I could almost pretend he was getting baptized. The policemen are still in the kitchen, and their footsteps are soft enough that I can close my eyes and pretend they're not there at all. Other than the policemen, I might as well be standing on the roof the same early morning a desperate woman plunged her only daughter beneath the dark surface. But it's not that morning. This morning, I am almost 17 years old, and my shoulders have grown strong and broad as my grandfather's once were, the calluses on the pads of my fingers tough as his those nights he cradled me into fitful sleep. This morning, Grandpa is dead, and the bog is mine, though the bog does not speak to me. I think that when fall comes this year, I will choose one of the boys and marry him and have a child with him. I'd like him to take me beyond the bog. The boy that had sex with me promised to take me beyond, but he was lying. He wasn't lying at the time, I don't think, but I was 15 and he was 20 and he got bored waiting for me to grow up. When he told me he was marrying somebody else, I cried for weeks. Grandpa chased him away with the gun he used to shoot coyotes, but then called him every day to come back and marry me. Every day except for the last 2 weeks, when he could no longer see where the phone was, let alone its numbers. It occurs to me that the boy is the only one who would have known Grandpa was dying. He's the only one that could have called the policeman. My chest stings the same way it did when he showed up with a ring on his finger and explained to me what it meant. I used to wish that boy would come back to visit me, but I don't care anymore. There are other boys with trucks that can take me beyond. I don't know exactly what's beyond the bog, but I'll know soon enough. I think it must be the market. Grandpa told me that I'd gone to the market once when I was a child, but I don't remember it. I don't remember anything but the bog. I hear one of the policemen coughing downstairs. I think it sounds like a coyote almost, the scratchy way it's all throat and no lungs. When my mother was alive, we had dogs. The last dog died when I was 13 years old. He couldn't run and wouldn't eat, instead lying on the rug in the living room and whining pitifully. Before Grandpa shot him, he brought him out into the bog and held him in the water for hours, pacing with him until his panting was no longer labored with pain. Yesterday, Grandpa asked me for that, for a last day free of pain. For almost a full afternoon, I held him in the bog and relieved his bones of their own weight. The water was so cold that even in my waders, my legs went numb, but Grandpa didn't seem to notice. He just looked up into the slated sky until his muscles stopped tremoring. I like to think that his last conversation was with me, but I know it was with the bog. I would have liked to have been a part of it, but at least I was there, walking lazy circles until his eyes fell closed and I guided his head under the water. Grandpa started thrashing once he could no longer breathe, his once strong chest rising and falling as it tried to draw air into his lungs. He had told me that this might happen, that his body might try to fight against his mind. He told me that it was all right, that he was prepared. He told me he wanted the bog to take him, but I won't let Grandpa suffer. I hadn't ever shot anything besides cans before I shot Grandpa, but my hands were steady. It was only after I walked out of the bog that my hands started shaking. I look down. They're still shaking. In the house, I hear policemen talking. I can't hear what they're saying, but one of them keeps coughing. I want them to leave. The sun is almost over the trees now, but not quite. Shadows of barren branches reach their claw-like hands towards me. I'm still holding Grandpa's coyote gun. I haven't put it down since yesterday. I haven't slept, either. The house is too empty to sleep in. There's enough light now that I can see the cranberry buds. I think about how they only become something people want once they have left the bog. I want to see it happen. I want to stand on the factory floor and watch them be pressed and sugared and pumped into perfectly uniform bottles. I don't want to be in a concrete room. I hear the policemen coming up the stairs, breathing heavy. Soon they'll crest the staircase and be right outside my room. My door is open. They could see me if they looked to their left, but they won't look to their left because they don't know I'm standing on the roof. They're not going to take me to a jail with no windows. This fall, I'm going to marry a boy, and he's going to take me beyond the bog. I'm going to get into the back of the truck, and I'm going to see the market. The bog doesn't speak to me. It doesn't have to. I understand it now, how sometimes you just have to protect yourself. I forgive you, I whisper to the bog. I forgive you, the bog speaks back in my voice. I forgive you.
Wow. We just heard the bog doesn't speak to me. Did I get that right?
Yes.
And Allison Detterman is here in the studio with us. Tell me about this piece.
I started writing this in July of last year, and I didn't call it finished until December. And so I spent pretty much 6 months writing the whopping 7 pages of this story. And obviously, over that process, there were a lot of different iterations as I tried to figure out what this story was really about. I remember in the first draft of this story, the entire thing was centered on the baptism. Almost immediately, like within a day, I wrote 10 pages just about the baptism. And so the original story that I was telling was kind of just a look at this strange belief that the family had, you know, that the bog was kind of a deity in the context of their world. And it made it a really imagery-heavy story, so nothing was really happening. So then when I realized that the story needed another dimension to it, the story morphed into almost a eulogy as the girl standing on the roof remembers her grandfather and come to terms with growing up. And it was better, but it still wasn't what I was trying to write about. And so the problem, I think, was that I wasn't writing a story about having a strange belief or the need to grow up and to leave people behind. I was trying to write about the quiet desperation of being isolated and the subdued chronic terror of feeling like there's no good way out. So once I keyed into that, I think I was really able to fine-tune the story to produce the emotion, hopefully, that I was trying to get at.
I think so. As I was listening to you read it, and it is, I had read the piece before we brought you into the studio, and it really is so different hearing you, you know, deliver the words with all the intonation and all the intention that you bring to it as the writer, as the person who wrote this. And I wrote down abuse and isolation and feeling trapped mm-hmm. and trauma mm-hmm. and murder yeah. and that strange relationship that can happen between a person or a group of people in a place when they grow strange together mm-hmm. over years or decades. Mm-hmm. So I think it was incredibly effective.
Oh, thank you so much.
And what does this draw from your life or any experiences you've had or any particular piece of creative work that spoke to you? Like, where did this come from? This is a really interesting place you've taken us to.
Yes. So my aunt and uncle had just moved to the Cape and had a house at the Cape. And I saw a cranberry bog at night, I think, or dusk. And I was like, that's the scariest place I've ever seen in my life, just because it was unfamiliar to me. And so I started thinking about, you know, I took a walk in the cranberry bog and I started thinking about kind of the dangers of the cranberry bog and what growing up there would mean. And then this summer I went back and I saw it again during the daytime, and it was a lovely cranberry bog, absolutely nothing creepy about it, but it was that original moment where it was, yeah, and we were in the middle of COVID too. And so I was feeling the effects of being isolated and, you know, feeling like, when is this ever going to end? Is this ever going to end? And I think that absolutely influenced my writing of the piece as well.
Right. Is there actually a way out?
Right.
When it feels so unreal that there could be.
Right.
So shifting gears, where are you from? And how do your places and people of origin inform your creative work?
I'm from northern Massachusetts, very northern Massachusetts, right on the border of New Hampshire. And it's a suburban place, and everyone there has been my entire life so supportive of me and so kind to me. I was absolutely not raised in isolation like the girl in this story. And then I moved here. I'd never lived outside of Massachusetts, and then I moved to Yukon, and I've loved it here too. I've found everyone here to be super kind and supportive, and I think that also nourishes your creativity when you feel supported by a community of people that you love.
Absolutely. And why do you write?
Oh, great question. I write creatively absolutely to get a handle on my own emotions, I think. And one of the hard parts about being human for me is that I can't make someone else feel the way that I feel. Like, I could tell my roommate a story about, oh my God, my lab today was so long, it was like 3 hours long, and, you know, it was so tedious, and everyone was talking over me, and it was just a terrible day. But I can't make her feel angry or frustrated or bored unless I write a story that puts her in somebody else's head. And so I think having that mutual third person that is fictional, that you can both relate to and relate to your own experiences, can actually help you connect emotionally to another person as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And writing can be incredibly therapeutic,
particularly
depending.
Yeah, I absolutely do find it therapeutic.
On where you're coming from. I think some of my most profoundly important moments of reflection or insight into my own life or what was going on or whatever had to do with writing and reflecting on that writing and that strange relationship with, like, oh, I wrote all of that. I guess that's all coming from somewhere.
Right, yeah, totally.
Tell us about writer's block.
Oh, geez. I absolutely have writer's block, and I have writer's block constantly, and it's a very annoying thing, but I'm lucky enough to not be a full-time writer. I don't know if I should say lucky enough. I'd love to be a full-time writer, but I'm not currently a full-time writer. And so there are no external deadlines for me. There's nobody saying, you have to get this project in at this time. And so I really do have the freedom to, if a project is not ready to be written, I can set it aside and work on something else, work on something maybe that's not even writing related. And then eventually, most of the time, I'll get the eureka moment where I'm like, oh, here's how I want this story to end, or here's what this character would say in that situation, or even, wow, now I'm in an emotional state where I feel more empathetic towards my character and can relay her worldview better. And sometimes I don't get there, you know, sometimes a piece is just blocked, and then that's a sign that I probably should move on and write something else, find a different home for those characters and those words.
Absolutely. Do you have sort of a writing project that you could describe as a great white whale? Is there something that you're sort of obsessed with and you keep working on, but you're just not making the kind of progress you're hoping to make?
Absolutely. I've been working on a novel for 3 years, and it feels like it's never, ever going to get finished, but I'm still hammering away at it every day.
And you just got to put in the work and hope you find that right place. So,
exactly.
So is it, are there things you can talk about? I don't know where you are in the creative process, but can you tell us about the novel?
Absolutely. So I do have a full manuscript. So I wrote the novel, I wrote it in full, and then this summer I threw everything away. I threw away 60,000 words and I started from scratch, and now I do have another manuscript. So I'm pretty far along, but it still doesn't feel ready to me. The novel follows Callie, who's a 15-year-old girl living in a down-on-her-luck fishing town and still grieving the death of her older brother. And she's been left to live with her grandmother as her father, who is a fisherman, is out at sea. So early in the summer, a preacher moves to town with his daughter, promising that through God he's going to be able to make the fish come back to the local beach. So my novel follows Callie and her relationship with the preacher's daughter as the two of them are kind of sucked into the church's little world. And what the novel's trying to do is it's trying to look at the coming-of-age arc of young women through the lens of those ferociously loyal and deeply formative girlhood relationships. But right now it's doing that unsuccessfully, so there's a lot more work to be done before it's ready to be published. And some of that or all of that description might change as I get deeper into editing, but that's where I'm at right now.
Sounds fascinating. I'm ready to buy a copy once it's out. You know,
thank you.
Put me on the mailing list or whatever. What do you read? What do you like to read?
Oh, all sorts of stuff. I like to read young adult books. I like to read cult books. I've been on a self-help book kick recently, so all sorts of genres. Yeah, there's really nothing I don't like except for straight horror. And everyone tells me you would love Stephen King, and I know myself, and I don't think I could do it. But yeah, anything but horror.
All right, excellent. Any one book or author you would recommend people check out?
Yeah, if you're into thriller or science fiction or that side of literature, I would say Blake Crouch. If you're into a softer, more young adult side of fiction, I would say A.S. King.
All right.
Yeah.
Awesome. I always like to know what other people are reading because, I mean, the reading list just gets longer. It never gets shorter.
Yeah, still. No, 100%.
Where can people find you and your work? Where can they keep up with you?
They can follow me on YouTube, which is Allison Detterman. And I talk about writing and I talk about what books I'm reading. And then I also do a vlog series. So just what's been happening in my life. They could also find me on Instagram or Facebook or pretty much anywhere, just under Allison Detterman.
All right. Awesome. Well, if you choose to pursue writing, I think you have an incredibly bright future in front of you.
Thank you so
I'm
much.
I'm so moved by your work, and I feel so lucky to have you on the show with us today. So thanks so much, Allison, for coming in. The piece we heard was The Bog Doesn't Speak to Me, and this is Allison Detterman. Anything else you want to say before we close out the show?
Nope. Thank you so much for having me. It was super fun.
I want to express my sincere gratitude to Allison Detterman for joining us on the show today. I hope you enjoyed this episode and that you'll join us next time. Thanks for listening to Words Aloud.
If you'd like to submit your work for an appearance on Words Aloud, you can send it to wordsaloudshow@gmail.com. That's wordsaloudshow@gmail.com. This show is produced with the support of WHUS Radio at the University of Connecticut. We're available wherever you get your podcasts, and if you want to help us grow the show, please share it with your friends, follow on Spotify, or rate and review on Apple Podcasts.